is foundational, and it brings us back to this core practice. You can't do discernment. You cannot do discernment unless there's constatation and presence. Presence and constatation, just to review. Presence is that immersion into the life in which we exist. It is our true selves, it is our true presence, and it is that loving presence that holds us. And we must ascend to that presence and be in that presence to do this work. It's not possible to do it outside of that. If it's outside of that, it's simply egoic. Presence is the constant, and it's the only place from which true discernment can take place. And with that, because presence is love and compassion, it's detached from judgment. And that's constatation, observing without judgment. And you can only do that, I can only do that from presence, from the heart, from the nous, from that place within us where the divine glory dwells. And we ascend into that place, and there we are united in presence. You can't separate yourself from that presence, because ultimately that's who you are. You are that presence. You are that observer. If we allow it, we naturally fall into a unity state. And I know right now you're saying, oh, if I could get there. Let me just say, it is your natural state. We think the egoic state is natural because it has been the place we have, it's been our fallback position. But we're learning that it is not the natural state. And we're learning to more and more ascend into that presence and there observe with love and compassion and begin to do this work. That's foundational. And if we aren't doing this, please do not bother about where we're going today, where we were yesterday. Because you'll end up only denigrating and harming yourself. It's that serious. We can't do spiritual work from the ego. This is where humans get into trouble.
What term would you give for the opposite of egoic state?
The theocentric state.
Theocentric?
Theocentric.
Okay, thank you.
Centered in God, centered in presence.
Lord.
Yes.
It occurs to me as you're speaking that one of the difficulties I think that we have in our culture is that word ascend implies climbing upward under self.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where if we were talking about words the other day, where maybe if we were to change the phrasing to just releasing or falling backward or falling inward.
I started to use the word descend. And it's almost worse, you know what I mean?
Right, there's right, no, right.
Yeah, yeah. Where's the language to find this? Because it is present to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the word ascend because it's moving beyond that egoic state. It's present to us,
mm-hmm.
and yet it is higher than the egoic state.
It's more so.
I think the word transcends the egoic state is exactly
right. I like that.
Right. And then the image of the wings is spirit lifting us out of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Thank you. I completely agree. So The question arose yesterday afternoon, where do we find the authority to use the instruments of restoration? And this is where we find the authority. It's in, and again, the language is so difficult because it's negative language, but self-negation in transcending self, that separate self, that egoic I. And we naturally fall into the presence. We naturally fall into that place of communion and union. It's what we're made for. It's why we're here. But we're made for death as well. And it's why we're here. But we fight it with every fiber of our being, and there's a reason we fight it, because we want to exist. And it feels like we're losing existence. But it, all of these passages, they're deaths, they're process that's practicing death, it's participation in the death. And so death isn't what our culture says it is. It more naturally is a rebirth. It's a rebirth.
Are you using death, or is there a connotation or tie-in with detachment?
Sure, detachment is a kind of death, that's what I'm saying.
Death of the ego.
Mm.
It's a letting go of that which we have so tenaciously held on to. And it starts with our smaller selves.
Anytime we create a void, we're
I'm talking. Sorry?
Anytime we create a void, we're really talking about a death.
Yes. This is why we emphasize that first step that the Tetragrammaton, that is the first step, is the creation of the void. It's the creation of that bowl into which is filled with spirit. So just listen to a couple readings. This is Rumi. Now comes the final merging. Now comes everlasting beauty. Now comes abundant grace. Now comes boundless purity. The infinite treasure is shining. The mighty ocean is roaring. The morning of grace has come. Morning? No, this is the eternal light of God. Who occupies these beautiful forms? Who is ruler and who is prince? Who is the wise one? There's nothing but veils. The wine of love removes these veils. Drink with your head and with your eyes. Use both eyes, use both heads. Your head of clay is from the earth. Your pure inner awareness is from heaven. Oh, how vast is the treasure which lies beneath the clay. Every head you see depends on it. Every atom of this world hides an infinite universe. Oh, cup bearer, free us from the facade of this world. Bring more wine, bring barrels full of wine. Our eyes see too straight past the truth. The light of truth shines from Nazareth, Jerusalem, Mecca, Tabriz, Collegeville, from beyond the beyond. Yet that light is here, shining through every particle of this world. That's the insight of what this world is. That's why we're here. Participate, fully participate. Turn to page 59. That paragraph, it's really the first full paragraph. God governs the world by authority, not by force. Would you read it aloud?
God governs the world by authority, not by force. If this were not so, there would be neither freedom nor law in the world. And the first three petitions of the Lord's Prayer, Pater Noster, Sanctificator,
Nomen Tuum, yeah, we know what it is, our Father who art in heaven,
would lose all meaning. He who prays these petitions does so solely with the purpose of affirming and increasing divine authority and not divine power. The God who is almighty, not virtually but actually, has no need at all to be petitioned that his reign may come and that his will may be done. The meaning of this prayer is that God is powerful only in so far as his authority is freely recognized and accepted. Prayer is the act of such recognition and acceptance. One is free to be believing or unbelieving. Nothing and no one can compel us to have faith. No scientific discovery, no logical argument, no physical torture can force us to believe, i.e. to freely recognize and accept the authority of God. But on the other hand, once this authority is recognized and accepted, the powerless become powerful. Then divine power can manifest itself. And this is why it is said that a grain of faith is sufficient to move.
Okay. God, who is almighty, not virtually but actually, has no need at all to be petitioned that his reign may be come and that his will be done. We're talking about authority but not power here. First God's, and then ours. We're talking about finding the authority to do this work. And here he's describing it. This isn't an intellectual exercise. This isn't a belief system or exercise. But it is an exercise in experience, human experience. Recognizing that we are in presence, we have that presence, we participate in that presence to do this work. Your will be done on earth as in heaven. There's a unity of experience. There's two wills that come together in this moment, in this experience, that are present to do this work. And apart from that, there is no authority to do this work. Turn to page 57. Now, we're coming back to the work that we've been talking about. This passage of four, what he calls the four emptinesses, and he's using the Kabbalistic viewpoint that humans must be emptied exteriorly, interiorly, mentally, and so forth. We're going through those emptinesses. And so today we're going to focus upon the interior emptinesses. Yesterday we looked at the exterior and our attachments to things, our attachment to the world. But here he's asking us to do this work as we look at our interior selves, our attachments to the causes of our exterior attachments, our attachments to those things that cling inwardly to us. So we're looking at the emperor has therefore renounced movement. The bottom of the page, we read this before, but we're coming back to it. We're reading it before to tell us where we're going today. We want to look at it more in depth. So would someone read that paragraph?
The emperor has therefore renounced movement by means of his legs and action by means of his arms. At the same time, he wears a large and heavy crown. And we have already meditated on the meaning of the crown with regard to that of the empress, which has a double meaning. It is the sign of legitimacy on the one hand, but is also the sign of a task or a mission by which the crown is charged from above. Thus, every crown is essentially a crown of thorns. Not only is it heavy, but it also calls for a painful restraint with regard to the thought and free or arbitrary imagination of the personality. It certainly emits rays outwards, but these same rays become thorns for the personality within. They play the role of nails piercing and crucifying each thought or image of the personal imagination. Here, true thought receives confirmation and subsequent illumination. False or irrelevant thought is riveted and reduced to impotence. The crown of the emperor signifies the renunciation of freedom of intellectual movement, just as his arms and legs signify his renunciation of freedom of action and movement. He is deprived of the three so-called natural liberties of the human being, those of opinion, word and movement. Authority demands this.
Oh my.
That's that's packed.
Yeah. Well, it's getting at the core of our individualism. It's getting at the core of our identities. And as he says, it's a painful restraint. This marks a stage that is more painful than exterior attachments. The renunciation of personal knowledge and, as he calls it, arbitrary imagination of the personality. What do you hear there?
The who arbitrary. We think we are.
Fantasies.
Who we think we are. Who we think we are.
Yeah. What were you saying?
I think fantasies.
Yeah.
Who we are.
Absolutely. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The arbitrary imagination of the personality. It's how we identify. This is who I am. How often during the day do we identify what we like, what we don't like? Who we are and who we aren't. We see our personalities projected and say, that's who we are. It's getting at the core of that process. And this is the crown of thorns to the ego, as he says, our personality. It's a crucifixion. Here is the crucifixion of personal knowledge. It's crucifixion of the image of our personal imaginations, our separate selves. But here we're making room for true spiritual knowledge. We're making room for a new identity until we are void of the old. As long as we cling to our personal identities, our personal imaginations of who we think we are, what we must have, what we must be. There's no room for the new. What were you going to say?
I was going to say it reminds me of reading about my type on the Enneagram. You know, I read about it and I go, ouch, ouch, ouch.
No. Ultimately, it's pointing to the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is almost impossible.
Wouldn't we have to give up even our identity as the Enneagram number? I mean,
if you're clinging to it.
You are not that. That's the point of the Enneagram.
Yeah,
we are not that.
You've identified here.
Right.
And you've stopped here. And it's much too small. So, absolutely. Absolutely. So, we're talking here about, again, the purified volition. That which, from this place of constatation and presence, there is the ability to be emptied of self. There's the ability, as Jesus said in Matthew, you have to start with humility, the poverty of spirit. And if we don't start there, if we don't start with presence, don't go there. Don't attempt this work.
Poverty of spirit?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, having renounced all action externally, we're turning within, recognizing that our intellectual movement, and this is where Americans just pride ourselves in our independent thinking, that is, our personal opinion, our personal ideas, our independence, our decision-making, it has to come into the light of truth. It has to come into the light of truth. And this is the ego's throne and its prized possession. And what we're hitting at here is our needs and our desires. This is the rational person's glory, their uniqueness, their independence. What's being asked is becoming increasingly more difficult for us. And, yes?
Spencer. So, is this when someone joins an order, and in a particular order, one of their rules is obedience. Is this a way of getting at that?
In the West, monasticism was based upon these concepts. So indeed it was to give up my personal identity. You take on a new name, get rid of your clothes, and you take on certain vows, and those vows echo these renunciations. And it was an attempt to get at that. The problem is, when the ego does the work, it can be dangerous. And there are so many stories, and I think for many monastics, they get this. But I was talking to a woman this past week who came to see me. She spent years in a monastic order. And she went there as a young girl, and all this was imposed upon her, but it didn't come from the freedom of love.
Yeah.
It came from exterior oppression, and it was destructive and unhealthy. And so it's beautiful if it comes from the interior, and it's and it becomes the act of love and compassion. So yes, the answer is it's an attempt to get at this. Absolutely.
It was always love that wrestles with the ego then.
What'd you say?
It's always love that wrestles with the ego.
Oh, absolutely.
That's the way of getting beyond the egoic.
Yes, absolutely. But if it's not love that's attacking the ego, it's done in judgment and fear. Mm-hmm. And that's where so much damage can take place. This echoes Jesus' call to discipleship. None of you can be my disciples if you do not give up all your possessions. And yesterday we looked at exterior possessions. Here we're looking at what possesses the heart, what possesses the soul. So it's a renunciation to those who would find spiritual freedom and authority. But this renunciation takes us deeper. Here Yeshua's instructions are taken internally, asking what possesses us at our volitional level. What runs volition? How do we make the choices of what we want and what we don't want? Check it out. Usually it's your personality. What are we seeking? Our text says, the emperor has established in himself this fourfold emptiness. So at each level of his being, he's making room, he's making space for some fullness. But there must be an emptiness before that space can be filled. And of course, we're going to talk more on this as we get into the fourth step. But for now, we're being asked to make space within an intellectual space, not clinging to ideas, to desires, or identities. Where are you in this? How are you feeling at the moment? Remember that the word disciple refers to someone following a discipline. This particular renunciation is aiming at our self-centered life and living. In other words, we're speaking of dethroning the false self, that I that we usually identify. But we're discovering the true self. And that's why presence and falling into presence, as Diana said, is so essential. This is a step toward a theocentric life, not an egocentric life. And this is the aim, the purpose, the goal. Reading from yesterday's work with the Empress, just listen to this. This is the aim of sacred magic. It's nothing other than to give freedom to see, to hear, to walk, to live, to follow an ideal, and to be truly oneself. To give sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, the ability to walk to the lame, life to the dead, good news or ideals to the poor, and free will to those who are possessed by evil spirits. It never encroaches upon our freedom. restoration of which is its unique aim. This is the path to true freedom. This is also, of course, hitting at the core of our spiritual wants and desires. Are we clinging to expectations the way things should be? To theories, to theologies, to ideas? We're invited to detach. In order that we might find the truth. The truth doesn't lie in our formulas. The external renunciation of the world has to be followed by renunciation of desire, a desire for the world. And this is the hardest step that's as embedded within us, and our ego is formed around it. And it was formed around a false concept, as we said yesterday. It was formed around a dualistic worldview. What we want is who we are, we think. Most of us coming to this step begin to face insecurities and a tremendous unsettlement. And I'm speaking to myself here as well as you. It disturbs the core of our identities. St. Macarius the Great, who was a student of St. Anthony, who is often called the first of the desert ascetics, asked this: what does it mean to renounce one's own self except to give oneself completely to the teaching and never accomplish absolutely one's own desires, but to be totally available to the Word of God? This was the foundation of monasticism. Saint Anthony was the father of monasticism. Mm. So what we're doing here is hitting at the heart of Western civilization. It's what we're founded upon, my personal happiness. My freedom to become myself. It goes counter to our way of life and living. Perhaps we're almost incapable of accepting the necessary second renunciation. I'm not sure. Many years ago, while I was living in the, had just returned to the Napa Valley, I began to attend a Russian Orthodox church. It was an ancient church that had been actually founded before California was American. It was a Spanish territory, but in the north there was a Russian settlement, and they had moved inland from their military establishment on the coast to grow vegetables. They moved into the Napa Valley, and there was still a old monastery there that had ancient icons. It was just a beautiful place. I still love that place. There was an old Russian priest there that had come from Russia, and I used to go to him for spiritual direction. And there were, in the convent there, there was an old convent, there were some old Russian nuns. They looked like they were 200 years old. And maybe they were. But there was a whole group of younger nuns, in fact, the Mother Superior. And most of them were converts from Catholicism and the Anglican Church.
Wow.
And they were, the Mother Superior had left the Episcopal Church when we started ordaining women in the 70s. And she became Russian Orthodox, and she was Mother Superior. But what I was going to say is, this old Russian priest I'd gone to for spiritual direction said to me, these nuns can't do this work.
He said that?
He said, I'm not sure Americans can do this work.
Oh, America.
You can't ever submit to something higher than the small self.
Mm-hmm.
And I've often thought about it. Of course, he was speaking to me in my work when he was saying this, and I knew what he meant. This is the hardest work, and we're formed around this. We're so full of the pride of our self-independence and who we are. We've worked hard at it. And now can we let go to find something higher, something bigger, something truer? If the nature of this second renunciation is understood, we'll see that it goes counter to our way of life and our thinking. This passage points to a major blind spot in humanity and the reasons for the injustices and the sufferings that we're creating today. We're destroying our world for personal freedoms.
Yeah.
We can't let go. It's all about me. I want it, and I want it now. And I want it all. I want to be rich, and I'll do it at the expense of anyone else.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. Do not love this passing world, John wrote, or anything that is in the world. The love of Abba God is not in those who love this world, for anything that this world has to offer, the cravings of the flesh, the cravings of the eye, the boastful pride of life, never come from Abba God, but only from this world. And this world with its cravings is passing away, but anyone who does the will of God will not pass away. We're clinging to our cravings. It's how we identify ourselves until we've taken this spiritual step into the emptiness of cravings. St. John of the Cross, in his poem On the Dark Night, put it this way: I entered in I know not where, and I remained, though knowing not, transcending knowledge with my thought. Transcending knowledge with my thought. That which comes from the presence, the true self. By renouncing one form of knowledge, we empty ourselves to receive the greater truth, which the mind cannot receive. Through prayer, our field, the noose, is cleared. And without image, and in that empty field, the Word of God is sown. Here we're learning the true value of the treasure. We're discovering that true treasure. And it begins to take fruition within us. Of course, this is paradoxical, isn't it? Meister Eckhart said, how can it be that detachment of the understanding comprehends all things? How can it be that detachment of the understanding comprehends all things? Without form or image, without turning outward or transforming itself. He goes on, I say it comes from simplicity. For the more pure and simple a person is within, the more simple that person will understand all multiplicity while remaining immutable. For God is the immovable good, remaining still in God's own self, unmoved and motionless, yet moving all things.
Can you read that first sentence again? How can the detachment...
How can it be that detachment of the understanding comprehends all things? It's paradoxical. We can only answer that in our own experience. We can't answer that intellectually. It doesn't make sense. and this speaks to the second renunciation, going beyond discursive thought and all the activity of the mind to that still place within the presence, what our early teachers of our tradition called the nous, what Yeshua called the inner chamber, where we're invited to go to commune, closing the door on all knowledge and the pride of life. So put down your pens and pencils and papers. Relax, gently close your eyes. Be simple, gentle, be with your breath, be with your presence. It is in God we live and move and have being. We are in that presence and we can fall into that presence. Just let yourself fall into that presence. Be immersed there. Inside and out. Here there's no separate self. Here there's only presence. This is the observer. This is your true self. This is love. This is compassion. This is the unity self. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Ideas, language, even the phrase each other don't make any sense. Lay down in that grass. This is the simple truth. It's so simple and so obvious. It holds us and embraces us. As I said at the beginning, it's our natural state. Lifted to God, to the presence. And this is where we do our work. I'm going to invite us in the next hour to do a personal reflection. What I'm going to give you is actually the third chapter from the Cloud of Unknowing. Mm-hmm. It's speaking to this work. It's what this is all about. It's the ability to lift the heart, to awaken the heart. That's what the prayer is about. That's what contemplation is about. That's what our practice is about. And from there, everything else takes place. But we must return to that core practice of awakening the heart. Awakening the heart, because it awakens in that presence, and it's driven by love. This work is driven by love. And if it's not driven by love, then don't even bother.